Come right in, pull up a chair. It's time once again to gather around the gaming table with your friends at The Gaming Gang. Proudly sponsored by Victory Point Games and Collins Epic War Games. This time around, Elliot will be reviewing Panic Station from Stronghold Games, as well as The Legend of Drizzt from Wizards of the Coast. Jeff will be reviewing Nightfall Blood Country from AEG, U-Boat Leader from Danvers and Games, and Nitro Dice from Minion Games. We'll have news, views, and more on this episode of The Gaming Gang. And now, here's your hosts, Jeff McAleer and Elliot Miller.
Hi, I'm Jeff McAleer.
And I am Elliot Miller.
What's going on, my friend?
Not much.
Yes, I know. I've
been pretty quiet.
I know I still sound horrible.
Yeah, you sound all right.
Yeah.
Just break into a horrible coughing fit every
Yeah, well, you know, it's what's known as Valley Fever out here in the Arizona Valley. It's not actually, well, it's sort of pneumonia. It's sort of Valley Fever anyway. But we're still going to have to deal with it and try to do the show.
We'll barrel through, man. We can do it.
I know. It's Thanksgiving week.
Hell, it'll probably be Thanksgiving when this comes out.
No, it'll be the day before. Yeah, remember, I'm not working right now because I've been sick. So not only will I be on my way to the poorhouse, but that gives me some extra time to edit the show. So the show should be up fairly quickly as I'm on my way to debtor's prison.
All right. Well, as long as you get it up before then.
Well, yeah, obviously. Well, there's no debtor's prison anymore, I don't think, but.
In Arizona, I believe there might be.
There may be. No. In Arizona, I don't think there would be. No, not in Arizona. Anyway, I understand that you, Elliot, were at the Chicago Toy and Game Fair this past weekend, correct? Got some news pieces about it. I was going to ask, what was your overall thoughts about the show?
Well, it was a lot of fun, just like it was last year. It's a higher concentration of children's games. You see a lot of the same people who go like from show to show, independent little publisher dudes who bring their one game and set up a booth. Like, yeah, you go to the shows and you see like Lou Ferrigno signing autographs.
I was going to say, Lou Ferrigno has a game design?
The Incredible Hulk, the game. It's unbelievable.
Okay, you're joking, right? Lou Ferrigno was not at Shytag.
No, no, no. But you know how he appears at like every
comic convention, yeah,
and sci-fi convention in existence?
Yes.
Well, you run across some of the same, like the people who have their one game and they set up the booth and they try to sell their one game there. So there was a lot of that. There were a few of the bigger publishers there, which was cool. I mean, Rio Grande was there.
Were they actually there or were they just demoing games?
They were demoing games. I mean, they have some that they sell, but they were mostly demoing. And of course, there was another Catan qualifier, number 632 for the year.
Right.
Out of the Box was there.
Did you get to say hi to Leah?
I did.
Yay! I did. She's very cool, so that's why I asked.
Yeah, she's very nice. And actually, I got a few news things about some of the games that I saw there. So I can get into that.
Very nice. So everybody had fun?
When we get up to it.
Who went with you?
Me and all of the kids except Brian. And my wife.
Your wife didn't go with you?
No, she went.
Oh, okay. You know, Brian's, what, 42 now?
Right. Dad, you know, what's with the games?
He plays games. What are you talking about? But yes, I personally, I don't think Shytag would be my sort of scene, seeing that I don't have kids. Yeah, so overall, good show. Was it better than last year?
I'd say it was about the same.
Okay.
Not better, not worse.
Just the same. Mm-hmm. The sameness.
They
of
didn't
it.
Have a giant Trojan horse that the kids could ride on.
I was wondering about that. Maybe the lawsuits that they had filed prevented
probably
them.
After four of them fell off and shattered their spines. You know. They did have Giant Stomple this time. So
Giant Stomple?
Yes.
Well.
Which I will mention that as well.
That's an all-new lawsuit coming then. All right. So let's get on with it. It's Thanksgiving week. We're hoping everybody's getting ready for their big turkey day out there. And for those listeners out there who are not in the United States, let's hope they're having a wonderful November week.
Right, because they're not thankful for anything. They have no thanks to give. Foreigners.
Jeez. Wow. Okay. All right.
Sorry, no, I'm just kidding.
Elliot's being a little too Amerocentric here.
Yeah, you know, I think they have Thanksgiving in Canada, too, don't they?
They do, but it's earlier than ours. You know what that's all about?
Giving thanks?
Yeah, but they're thankful that they're not Americans.
Can you blame them?
Hey, we got in trouble for this kind of discussion before. Let's move right along.
Moving right along.
On to the news.
Good evening, Mr. and Mrs. North and South American. All the ships and clippers at sea. Let's go to Brass Flash.
It's not Christmas unless Steve Jackson Games is involved. And there's more Munchkin Madness with Munchkin Christmas, which should be arriving in stores as we speak. Munchkin Reindeer Games and Booster Packs will have you causing trouble in Tinseltown. From their website, those scary reindeer are back, and they've brought new Santa monsters like Teeny Tiny Tim, Recalled Toys, and Mrs. Claus. You know what you have to do. Kill them and take their stuff.
Say Tinseltown?
Yeah, I said Tinseltown before.
What? So Hollywood?
No, tinsel as in Christmas tinsel.
Sorry, I was confused. Santa goes to Hollywood.
Yeah, well, maybe. And you're going to armor yourself in tinsel and grab the snowshoes and the reindeer hat. And sweet. Celebrate Christmas the Munchkin way with reindeer games.
With pain and death. No, I'm just picturing, you know, Santa, Arnold as Santa. Remember when I said I would kill you last, Rudolph?
It's not tinsel. It's not Christmas unless Steve Jackson Games. Well, it's not any month without Steve Jackson Games releasing some Munchkin expansion.
Hey, whatever works, man.
Whatever keeps the doors open, I guess. Yes.
That's right. Some of the games that I ran across at Shytag, the Chicago Toy and Game Fair. Well, they had Chaosel there. Now, Chaosel, I may have mentioned it before because I believe I saw it at Origins.
Or Gen Con, one of the two.
Or Gen Con. It's from Chivalry Games, and it's a 3D fantasy board game for 2 to 8 players.
Wait, you saw it at the Chicago Wizard World. You saw it at the Chicago Comic Convention.
Oh, was that it?
That's where you saw it. Yeah,
well, see? It was one of those, you know, the one game dudes.
Right.
And it does look very pretty with lots of plastic figures and plastic walls. And I have no idea how the actual game is played or if it's any good. But it's got a gigantic box and it looks
so
nice.
Go buy it now.
So go buy one now.
Go buy it. It's Christmas. You're going to buy crap anyway. Go get it.
I'm telling you, this box is gigantic. But hey, lots of good plastic. And this time I actually did get a chance to talk to the designer. I'm still editing all my little short interviews that I did, and I'll have that up as an extra website soon. So you can hear a little bit more about the pretty game with lots of plastic walls and figures. There's also a game called Power Trip. Now, this was a card game.
Which I'm always on.
Exactly. It's a card game. It's got elements.
Hey, I'm not done talking.
Can I finish? With elements of Uno, poker, and Flux. And it's actually an entertaining game, and I'll actually have a review of this game in the near future. My son Matt got to play a game, brought it home, taught us how to play. We played a game. We had a good time. It's a,
what did
it's
Matt
an interesting
think
little game.
He liked Hell, it.
He loved it.
Like it.
He loved it.
Really?
Yes, he loved it.
To be very honest with our listeners, your son Matt is normally fairly disinterested with most games.
Yeah, but he actually went and demoed a few games at this thing and sat down and played a few and liked, liked them.
Very cool. Yeah. Very cool. What else?
Bananagrams, apple letters, pears and pears, and fruitominoes. These are all Scrabble or Domino-like tile games from publisher Bananagrams. It's been out for a few years. They come in this zippered pouch that looks like a piece of fruit. And my daughter loved them already. But I will have some reviews of these games as will coming up soon.
Okay, which daughter loved them?
Oh, I guess I should clarify that. Aaliyah.
Okay.
The youngest.
Yes, the little girl. Yes.
The recently
nearly 5-year-old. Oh, she is 5 now.
Yes, she just
Oh, that's
five
right.
Last
yeah,
weekend.
She just had a birthday. Okay. Okay, yes, your 5-year-old enjoyed them. Okay.
All right, I haven't actually played them yet, but she loved taking these things out of the pouches, stacking up all these tiles. She just fell in love with them. So we'll see if it measures up to actual game experience. I have no idea.
Sure. Right. And what age group is that for? It's for kids? Little kids?
Well, it's kind of like Scrabble. two of them are like Scrabble, so that's not until they're actually maybe seven.
Spelling.
But the domino ones are kind of like matching games where they have pictures of fruit on them instead of actual domino pieces. So that's a much younger age.
Instead of the pips, they have a banana or apple, orange.
Yeah, exactly.
Pomegranate.
Now, I got to tell you, the coolest toy. Pomegranate?
Yeah, I was late on that one.
Pomegranate. Look, Daddy, it's a pomegranate.
Oh, yeah. Mm. Hey, that's a Brazilian banana. I can tell.
One of the coolest toys that they had there. Now, this is just a toy. Okay, so please forgive me.
So we can't talk about it. No, we can't talk about it.
No, I'm going to mention this toy.
No, hey.
It's the Flying Shark.
I thought you were going to say Flying Nun.
The Flying Nun. Whee, it's shaped like Sally Field. It's the Flying Shark. Air Swimmers Flying Shark from the William Mark Corporation was there. And it is this remote control 5-foot-long shark that you get filled with helium, and it swims from room to room, and it looks just like it's swimming underwater, the way its tail fin moves and everything. And it floats only maybe 3 to 5, 6 feet off the ground at most. And it's remote control.
3 to 5, 6, 12, 18 feet.
Okay, a range of 3 to 6 feet, I think, is a pretty accurate range to give.
It's a remote controlled inflatable dirigible. Is that what you're trying to tell
me? Yes, except it's a shark.
Yes, and you've never been to a hockey game or a basketball game and seen one of those floating around?
Don't mock it until you've seen it. That's all I can say.
All right, do you have video of this?
They have a video on their website.
No. Do you have video of this?
No, I don't have video of it. Go to the freaking convention. They got them at Toys R Us. I don't know.
Oh, I don't know. Do they? Do they have it at Toys R Us?
Sure do. They also have a clownfish, you know, Nemo, that you can get. They were amazing.
I thought maybe it was a fish with a clown face on.
Why? There's a game called Perplexus, and this is a 3D puzzle game that uses this clear globe.
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe the size of a softball. Or a little bigger than a softball. And it's filled with this maze of tracks. And you got to keep the little silver ball moving along the track without it falling off by rotating the globe like 360 degrees. And it's more of like a mental puzzle. And it's really difficult at first. And you almost have to memorize it. It takes you time to get the hang of it. And they have versions both for little kids and for adults. And it's from this company called PlaySmart. And those looked pretty neat, too.
I remember as a kid, my parents had one of these. It was like a wooden box, and they had two knobs. You were trying to get that steel ball through a maze without dropping in a hole.
Oh, yeah. I remember that game.
Well, I mean, there were loads and loads of different things like that. Is it similar to that, but more like three-dimensional?
It's similar. Since it's in a sphere, you have to drop it to a track by turning it this way, and then you got to rotate it around so that it'll go around this curve and then up this chute. It's really, you got to see it.
So you have to be really careful with your balls?
Exactly. You don't want your balls just falling out.
No, I know that. I did 3 days in jail when that happened one time. Not doing that again.
Oh, okay. I'm lost. Why don't you do another piece? I'll get back to this stuff.
I'm sorry. Did I throw you just off of your shy tag? All right. I'll pick up the pace here. AEG has released their first Legend of the Five Rings board game, Ninja, Legend of the Scorpion Clans. It was delayed, so it's finally getting out.
You mean it's just not coming out? I didn't even know that.
Yeah, they had some delays with it, some production delays.
Oh.
You reviewed that on the website and on the show. Oh, my gosh.
August?
No, I don't think it was August. It might have been, may have been early September that we talked about it. But it is finally out. Game centers around one very dangerous knight at a castle in the provinces of the Lion Clan. Honorable Lion Samurai stand vigilant watch around the castle, protecting it from harm. The Scorpion Clan sends one well-trained ninja to infiltrate the castle for various nefarious purposes. It may be to assassinate guests, or poison the well, or steal war plans, Whatever the goal, the ninja has vowed to accomplish it or die trying. Worse yet for the Lion Clan, the ninja has an accomplice, a traitor among the ranks of the Lion Samurai, whose true loyalty lies with the Scorpion. Also, in more AEG news, they have announced that they're sending out their Legend of the Five Rings collectible card game Emperor Edition demo deck packages to your local game stores. And this is across the world. AEG introduced these decks at last year's Gen Con, and they were a huge hit. Now they're bringing these demo decks to stores near you so the general public can also join in the fun. Stores are being encouraged to schedule demo sessions to introduce people to the game. This December, these decks will land. The nice thing is, they're absolutely free. But if you're a current L5R player, please don't pick one up. These are for new players of the game. So help the community by sharing your passion for L5R with new players and get them that free demo deck. If you want to build your own demo deck out of your own card pool, the deck lists are also available online.
Well, that's kind of cool.
Yeah, I thought that was very nice. I heard that 2012 is going to be a big Legend of the Five Rings collectible card game year.
Sweet.
They're looking to make different tweaks and things like that to bring more players in. And obviously, this is one of them.
Yeah. Sounds like a good plan so far.
I would think. Free is good.
So, you know, Miranda Enterprises.
So you've gotten a grip now?
Yes, I've got a grip. Agrippola.
Okay. I've got Agrippola, the zombie edition.
Miranda Enterprises has 6 abstract games, and these are all made of finished wood. And I will have a news piece about
finished wood? It's from Finland?
Yes. Oh, I can't do a Finnish accent. I was going to go into one.
I don't even know what one would be. Yeah, right. Sure, Magora.
Yeah, you're close. I'm going to have a news piece about all 6 of them, but several of them include Quadify, which is similar to a 3D Tetris game where you're forming a cube instead of, you know, the 2D version.
Like a Borg cube?
Like a what?
Borg cube?
Yes.
I thought you'd jump on that. You were like, Star Trek,
I couldn't understand the word Borg. Like, Borg?
Sorry.
Eternus is a type of 3D Connect 4 game, and it uses these wooden balls and these stakes that are arranged in like a circle.
You and these balls, man. Go ahead.
And you stack the balls on the stakes to you know, attempt to get your 4.
So wait a second. Somebody's staking your balls?
I never said that they weren't risks involved in gaming. There's always
man,
a
that's
danger.
That's a pretty big risk.
And then in Pathagon, players place these hexagonal wooden pieces in a path across the board, and they try to build 5 in a row in order to win. But the nicest thing about them is these are all like these wooden handcrafted games, and they look really nice. And I kind of like this, you know, the kind of game that you would have on like your coffee table, and then the kids would come by and throw them on the floor, and then the dog chews it up.
Just like coffee table book.
Exactly. So, and they do look amazing. So, Out of the Box was there, and they were running the giant Word on the Street game, which is always a lot of fun. Plus, they were running a raffle that was giving away a basket filled with copies of all of their games.
Wow.
Which was really nice. And they had this huge basket. Spin Master had a giant version of Stomple, giant Stomple, that Allie really enjoyed, my youngest. So we met the designer of Stomple, Greg Zima, and he was the guy running the full-size version.
Oh, man, I used to love his
I know.
Drink.
You can still get him in some places, too.
Can you? I thought they were long gone.
And he was the one running this full-size version and actually put off his lunch so that Aaliyah could get a chance to play a game. Because we stood there and waited for like 15 minutes for the other group to finish. And then they were going to stop it. And she was very sad. So he said, okay, we'll play one more game.
Well, that was
very,
very
cool. And he had no idea who I was or that, you know, I'm involved in this or anything like that. So it was very cool.
Nobody else does
either, so it doesn't matter. And it was really cute watching the little kids all carrying these huge Stomple tubes, because they were these huge cardboard tubes that were painted black, and then they had these half circle plastic pieces that represented the marbles, and you would stomp on the half circle things and they would go up inside the tube and that would make them disappear. And so all the kids are running around stomping each other's pieces.
Which I'm sure they would love.
Now, the word is that eventually Stomple, the game itself, will go to a plastic version for mass production. So I am suggesting that everybody picks up one of the wood versions now while you can, because these are absolutely gorgeous, these games. I have a few more things from Shytag, but why don't you go ahead and throw something in so I'm not monopolizing the first hour of the show.
I'm sorry, what was that? I had dozed off for a second. I was thinking about people staking my balls. Anyway, WizKids had postponed the release of the Lord of the Rings HeroClix starters. They were supposed to be out this month. Now they're scheduled for early December. Join your favorite Middle-earth heroes and villains as you test your wits in the Lord of the Rings HeroClix, featuring 21 precisely sculpted characters. Come on, it's HeroClix. They're not that precise. From the award-winning Lord of the Rings film trilogy, these figures are completely HeroClix compatible with Marvel and DC HeroClix. Gandalf battles Spider-Man, anyone? Aragorn versus Superman? The Lord of the Rings HeroClix is introduced in counter displays packed with 24 single-figure blind boosters. Yes, they're always blind boosters. As well as starter sets containing 8 figures each. There's campaign rules for recreating the epic battles of Middle-earth over multiple maps. I don't remember Spider-Man and Superman being involved in those, but hey, that's okay. It's been a while since I read The Lord of the Rings. You also get 6 maps, 48 horde tokens, an official rule book, and a set of themed dice forged from the depths of Mount Doom.
Sweet.
Which I don't really think they were honestly forged in the depths of Mount Doom. But anyway.
They can't do false advertising.
Of course. How do you think the National Enquirer has been around for so long? Hey, it can't be printed if it's not true. The Strike of the Eagle, the first in the Fog of War board game series by Academy Games, should now be in stores. Strike of the Eagle is a strategy game that simulates the tense action of the Polish-Soviet War of 1920. This war featured a return of sweeping cavalry attacks combined with new weapons and innovations such as planes, tanks, and armored cars. Gone was the static trench warfare of the First World War, where frontline changes were measured in yards. Instead, the gains of this war's campaigns were measured in hundreds of miles, from Kiev and beyond Minsk to the east, to Warsaw and the German border in the west. Strike of the Eagle is the first game in the new Fog of War series from Academy Games. This series covers pivotal wars of different eras, allowing players to relive and learn about the struggles that took place. The heart of this unique series lies in players placing secret orders on the map during each turn to bluff, mislead, misdirect, and outplay their opponents. The orders are then revealed and executed by the players' armies that are represented by wooden blocks. A 2-4 player game, Strike of the Eagle brings to life the Polish-Soviet War at your game table. The battle is now beginning. Pick up Strike of the Eagle at your local game store today. I have to be honest, when I talked to Uwe from Academy Games at Gen Con, and I did see this new series coming out, I saw Polish, and I'm like, oh, you know, gosh, it's Germans, Polish, 1939. And I was like, God, you know, would you want to be the Polish player in that game? The Germans rolled through there in, I don't know, a week and a half. And then I found out it was the Poles and the Soviets fighting it out. So, yes, it's much more balanced than it would be if it was Germany and the Poles in 1939. And it's kind of funny because I do believe that Uwe is Polish. So I think that he was looking for a topic that maybe, and this is no knock against the Poles, that maybe he was looking for something that was a battle or a war that the Poles actually had a shot at winning. Well, I mean, if you were like a Native American, would you be sitting there going, hey, you know, I really want to put together the Trail of Tears game. I think that would be good.
No,
you would be sitting there going, How do we figure out how to put together Custer's Last Stand as a game? Yeah.
I'm being honest. Like saying that you go back like 400 or 500 years to find a battle that the Poles won.
No, 1920.
Okay, that's not that far. Actually, it does sound like a pretty cool game. So.
It's Academy Games. Yeah. You know it's going to be good.
Now, the one thing from Chi-Tech that I do regret is that I missed talking to Daryl Hannah and Hillary Shepard about their game library from Discovery Bay Games that they published back in 2005.
Yeah, but Daryl Hannah's not all that hot anymore.
Well, that's probably why she's publishing games.
Well, you were talking about
inventing games.
Being regretful. I was like, well, yeah.
Still a chance to talk to Daryl Hannah?
Yes. What's wrong with that? No, I know. I'm teasing.
This is basically where players listen to the title and a synopsis from a real book, and then they write down what could be the first line to that book. And you earn points for each player who believes that yours is the real first line.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
It was the blurst of times. You stupid monkey. Sorry.
What? Huh?
Simpsons.
No, I was giving you the first line of a real book. Do you want to guess? Come on, come on. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
Oh, come on. Put me on the spot. I can't remember. It's A Tale of Two Cities?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, which I have, well, audiobooked, and which is an excellent, excellent book. They also have designed Famous Last Lines, which is a game from 2010, and that's similar to Library, but involves creating the last lines of popular movies. Now, I haven't had an opportunity to try it. I'm hoping to. Which reminds me, I thought I'd mention that I discovered that Tarantino is working on Kill Bill Volume 3, which is due out in 2014.
Wow. I'm excited.
Daryl Hannah will reprise her role as Ellie Driver. And, of course, Uma Thurman will be returning as well.
Yes, because they need a paycheck.
Movie news.
Oh, yeah. There you go. Hey, here's our new website. It's the Movie Gang.
Well, we have mentioned quite a few movies, I believe.
Well, yeah, of course. Movies that people would have seen.
I guess Kill Bill was very popular with the younger crowd when it came out.
I was younger when it came out. I didn't think it was all that great.
I don't know. I just tell you, I haven't seen them. So.
Okay.
They had this Young Inventors Challenge, too, that had all these young kids sitting behind tables. It was like a big science fair. And these kids had invented their own games, and they were showing them off so that the publishers and the public attending could check them out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the prize package was actually pretty impressive. It included dinner with a Hasbro executive.
Has been what?
Hasbro.
Oh, sorry.
And a trip to New York to present at the Toy of the Year Awards. Pretty nice for the little kids there.
Yeah, to try to pitch a game, sure.
Mm-hmm. That's all I got about Shite.
There are two Kickstarter projects that I want to mention. I know you have a couple. You do, too. From Collins Epic War Games comes a terrain expansion for Spearpoint 1943. For those who listen to the show and obviously check out the site, they know that one of our favorite titles that we ran across at Origins that we were completely unaware of is Spearpoint 1943.
Yep.
Now designer Byron Collins is adding a new wrinkle to the system, and it's available on Kickstarter. Frontline General Spearpoint 1943 Village and Defensive Line Map Expansion is going to be a map-based expansion to their fast-paced World War II-themed card game. The map expansion features a brand new level of tactical challenge for fans of the game. If you pledge $79, you can receive the expansion as well as the base game, plus a custom line of sight tool all in one. Also, Lock and Load Publishing has brought their first title to Kickstarter with War Party. In War Party, players command heroes and armies in a fantasy world beset by conflict. An alliance of dwarves and men are pitted in a battle of survival against the evil hordes of goblins and the nefarious undead. To win, players recruit massive armies, build cities, develop technology, and conquer territory in an effort to defeat their opponents by ultimately capturing their homeland. Beyond the mere battling of armies and world conquest, players direct the development of heroes to explore dungeons, battle fierce creatures, and gain valuable treasures and spells that can be used to turn the tides of war against their foes. As we record, War Party is only $500 short of their goal. So hit the Kickstarter site to check it out or visit our website to learn more.
And I got to admit, even though I'm becoming less of a fan of board games that are being funded through Kickstarter, simply because of the plethora of games that now are being funded this way, there's one game that's currently up for funding that I did want to make special mention of. And it's called Island Fortress.
Mm-hmm.
It's a worker placement type game where players are asked to build this mighty stronghold by the governor of an island, and players compete for victory points.
Aren't you the governor of a penal island?
It's populated with convicts and laborers.
Yeah, okay.
And the reason that I mention the game is that the designer, Brian Johnson, has already gone through two separate publishers of the game in its original format, which was a game about building the Great Wall of China, and it was originally titled Huangdi. After both publishers either went belly up or failed to gather the resources to actually bring the game to market, both publishers either went belly up or they failed to get the resources together to actually bring the game to market. The game was originally designed in 2005, and it's won several awards and competitions, and it's never seen publication. Brian was finally able to get the rights back to his game this year and worked with the Springboard campaign system over at GameSalute to completely revamp and rework and retheme the game into its new incarnation as Island Fortress.
Right.
And it was only then that he decided to form his own game company, which is Frostforge Games, and launched his funding project on Kickstarter. It is completely unimpressive in its prototype version, but the final game is promised to have great components, artwork, all the bells and whistles. And combined with the extensive playtesting and refining of the gameplay, I really do wish Brian good luck in his endeavor to finally bring his design to market. 6 years now?
Well, yeah, but that happens. And with a lot of developers and things like that, designers, they go to the company, says, oh, yeah, we'll take this on. They purchase the rights to the game.
Yep.
Not everybody does that. VPG, give you an example, their designers still own the rights to their games. You'll see that a lot of times where something was going to go out there and hit the public and the company goes, gone.
Yeah, yeah.
But I have to mention, everybody going to Kickstarter, I'm telling you, this is not good for the hobby. It's just not.
There's a lot of games out there on Kickstarter now.
There are loads of games on Kickstarter. It's very difficult to find something on Kickstarter.
Yeah, it is. It really is.
It is. It's not a very intuitive website to look around. And there are some instances where Kickstarter projects, people got screwed out of the We know for a fact that there were instances at Gen Con where there was someone who had a Kickstarter project who was selling copies of that game that was funded through Kickstarter, and the people who had funded the game did not have a copy yet.
Yes, that's right. I remember that.
I'm telling you, Kickstarter is not the end-all, be-all.
No, it's not.
And I find it very disappointing that all these people are taking their projects. And I'm not talking about Colin's Epic War Games. I'm not talking about Lock and Load. I'm not talking about the guy behind Fugitive Island or whatever it is. But I'm saying that...
Island Fortress.
I'm not talking about the guy behind Island Fortress. But if you look, you have companies out there who have the monetary means of bringing a product to print who are going to Kickstarter because they don't want to risk their own money on a project that may not sell. You got a lot of big companies out there going to Kickstarter that do not want to risk their own money. So they'd rather risk yours. I don't like that. I think it's bad for the hobby. I think it's bad business overall.
Oh, plus there was, 750 games at this year's Essen?
Yes.
You know, Kickstarter is just going to add to that. How many games a year can the hobby support, really?
Once again, I don't know the guy who designed Island Fortress, but you know what? If my game won multiple awards, my game concept won multiple awards, and I've been trying to get this in print since 2006, I would go and look at other avenues because you know what? You might be a great game designer, but you're probably a horrible business person. Because if your game is that good, it shouldn't have taken more than 5 years to possibly get it published.
Well, yeah, but if the guys who publish it buy the rights and have the rights for several years and then never bring it to market,
then don't get involved with fly-by-night companies. That's what it all boils down to. Or don't be stupid enough to sell the rights to your game, to your baby, to your creation, to somebody that you don't believe is going to bring it to fruition.
Well, we all have learning curve.
You know, I don't have a whole lot of sympathy for these people. If you don't know how the business works, then don't get in the business.
Well, how do you learn, though?
It's by not like going on the internet to figure things. Yeah, it is. You have the internet. You can go and find stuff out. If you just walk around with your head in the clouds, then you're going to be screwed either way.
Well, I think back then, the only way to get your game published was by going to different publishers and having them look at it and having them buy your design. There was no real other way to do it. Nobody
or
really
self-published.
Well, how many people self-published back in 2005?
A lot.
I think there was two. I just made that number
two.
Up.
I was going to say, self-publishing is effectively paying to have your game published. That's what it is. There were ways to get self-published in the 90s. Just like if you wrote a book that you thought was just awesome, just like you'll see nowadays, you have all these different authors, people on Facebook, oh, yeah, check out my new book, blah, 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 blah. It's print on demand.
Yeah, well, that is a new option now in the board gaming world, too.
Has been around for 20 years. I'm not ripping on this guy. I'm just saying, if my game was so awesome, it wouldn't have taken me 5 years to get it published.
Well, I don't know, because a lot of games take a long time for it to go through the iterations to actually reach publication. Like the Ankh-Morpork game, that Discworld game. Those guys said they've been working on it for like 10 years.
Yeah, working on it. It wasn't ready to go.
Well, I guess this one really wasn't ready to go either, because they re-themed the whole thing. All I can say is, yes, there is a lot of games showing up now on Kickstarter, and I don't see that being as good for the hobby either.
No, I think it's terrible for the hobby. Plus, I also look at it, you can have people who can go out there and find people to fund their trip to Essen to cover it as a media, yet you can't find people who are going to support an actual game where if they pay money, they get something out of it.
Right.
No, I'm just saying, I think Kickstarter is terrible for the hobby. I really do. I think it's horrible for the hobby.
Well, its whole intention wasn't mainly for board games. I mean, it's designed to kickstart all kinds of things.
I know. So. Actually, if I remember correctly, I believe Kickstarter was there to help people finance films.
Yeah, I've seen it used for that quite a bit, like college students who are trying to make a specific film.
Right. I think that was the original purpose of it. And now suddenly it's, hey, help me finance my new line of soap. Just like talking about how many games came out at Essen. I think that's terrible for the hobby, too.
750, man. Whoa.
Yes. And out of those 750, 50 will be good. The other 700, or worse. Yeah. And it was Essen. So for me personally, that's probably like 10 games I would think were good. And the rest.
Right.
I believe in making sure that people are aware of the different ways to save some money on games this season, for the holiday season, as they go out there and buy for their friends, their family, and let's be honest, for yourself. Petroglyph Games is offering massive savings on their board games this holiday season. You can pick up Guardians of Grixia for $9.99, and three other titles, Heroes of Grixia, Panzer General Allied Assault, and Panzer General Russian Assault for $11.99 each. We're talking about a 70% discount, maybe even more, on these games from their original retail price. So I would recommend pop over to Petroglyph Games if you're interested and pick them up on the cheap.
Wow. These are the board game versions, right? It's not like the iOS version.
No, no. These are board games.
Nice. Okay. I just wanted to mention that Victory Point Games is currently working on a new series of war games from the master designer, Frank Chadwick.
Yes, Frank Chadwick, the man behind GDW back in the day.
The Drum and Musket series is for fans of 18th century warfare, and the first game in the series will be Luthen. a war game of Frederick the Great versus Austria in the Seven Years' War. Now, the game is still in the works, but I am promised that it will be simple, clever, and an excellent time. And we'll keep our ears open for more information on the series as it comes out.
Very nice. Frank Chadwick, boy, I'm telling you.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool. That's one name in the war game, even role-playing game genres that everybody knows. My last piece of news, something that's absolutely not really gaming related. I know once in a while we like to share podcasts that we listen to that people might enjoy. The one I'd like to share is called We're Alive. You can find it at zombiepodcast.com. It is a show about, the zombie apocalypse. I'm a huge fan of old-time radio, and I enjoy audiobooks and so forth. It's an audio presentation of the zombie apocalypse, and it's posted normally every week or 2 weeks. Right now, they have two seasons of the show, and they're all together probably about 20 hours of podcasts. And it's the story. It's not zombie news or anything like that. It's an actual, like an old-time radio show would be. It's radio drama. Really? Yes. I really like it. I think sometimes some of the people who are involved in it are not the best radio actors out there, but the presentation is top notch. The sound effects are top notch. Sure, yeah, the way the zombies work out, I'm a little up in the air on. But as Ellie and I have talked about before, I had been working on some stuff for a zombie novel. Yeah, that's never been done before. And I'll be listening to this show, and I was just turned on to the show about a week, maybe a week and a half ago. And I'm like, damn it. I thought I was the only one who thought of that. But it is a really entertaining show as far as the zombie apocalypse hits LA. And once again, it's called We're Alive, and it's at zombiepodcast.com. And I've already reached out to see if I might be able to set up some sort of an interview with the people who are behind the scenes at it. Like I said, you'll be very, very surprised at how professionally presented the show is. And I think if anybody who's out there running a role-playing game that's set in the whole zombie apocalypse kind of theme, they would be really hard-pressed to find a better source of little nuggets for adventures than We're Alive.
Well, now I'm going to check that out tomorrow.
Zombiepodcast.com.
Wow, you never mentioned that.
No, because it's news. It's news to you, just like everybody else.
It is.
They post like a new 20-minute segment every week, although season 3 starts this winter.
Always on the lookout for
listening. Yes. Oh, yeah, I'm right with you. And like I said, I mean, some of the actors are pretty good. And some of them are like, oh, geez, man, you're killing me. You're killing me on here. But they have a cast of like 20 people.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Look at that. He's typing it right now. Zombiepodcast.com.
And now it's time for the Gaming Gang's game review. Let's try saying that 10 times fast.
I'm not going to try.
Cities have fallen. Cities have stood. But outside of those protections, humans must face the creatures of darkness on their own terms. In the lawless countryside of Nightfall, the beasts within can wreak havoc like never before. Blood Country brings all new strategies and tactics to Nightfall, introducing cards that can have additional impact and ability based on the use of specific wounds. Blood Country expands the dark and intriguing world of Nightfall by taking the story out of the embattled cities and into the rural areas of America. Designed by David Gregg, released by AEG just this year. It's for 2 to 5 players. Suggested ages is probably 12 and up, and you can play a game of Nightfall in about 45 minutes. Most people are already familiar with Nightfall, and Blood Country is the newest expansion to the series. The biggest difference, probably within the components of Nightfall Blood Country, is the box. It's a very, very small box, as opposed to when you have an expansion for, let's say, Thunderstone, which is normally in a typically sized AEG box. Mm-hmm. Blood Country comes in a very, very small pack, which is kind of cool. To be honest, you really don't need a huge box for everything else. So it's very economical, and let's be honest, it's probably very environmentally friendly too.
Sure, and easier to cart around.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was going to mention. I think, and I haven't tried it yet, but I think you could probably fit the cards from Nightfall and one of the expansions into this box.
Yeah.
So you don't have to lug everything else around.
Yeah, cool.
Now, I'm changing up the way I present reviews because I know a lot of people want to get as many reviews every time out, but they don't want to listen to a two-hour show. So I'm trying to shorten up my reviews a little bit and then probably get into a little more detail on the website itself. As far as Nightfall Blood Country, does it really add a whole lot to the core game mechanics? Probably not. There has been a change to the original drafting rules that call for random public archives to be selected and revealed before drafting starts. This small change is actually pretty effective in making the process a lot more strategic due to the fact that players now have some sort of frame of reference when they're drafting cards. In the older rules, random cards are just random. Now random cards kind of mesh a little bit better. Nightfall Blood Country offers a variety of cards with even more distribution of character types. And to be honest, some of the best characters I've seen for Nightfall are in Blood Country. This is where it really stands out. The core mechanics really haven't changed with the expansion, but the cards themselves have a lot of really interesting, a lot of unique capabilities. As far as wound types, now like bite, burn, bleed, now they're referenced directly in certain card text, and the type of wounds that you can have will make a difference. A lot of times, you'd be sitting there, and the only reason why you would worry about the kind of wound that you would have is for a tiebreaker.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Now, it's a little bit different, because depending on the kind of wounds that you already have, some effects can come into play. As far as Blood Country, sure, it's a little more of the same. It's not necessarily as far as the card effects, because they're unique. They're pretty fun. But as far as the theme, we're not really getting that far offside of what the original game was, except for taking it into more of the backwoods. So you'll have characters wearing baseball caps for trucking companies, and you have a werewolf who rides a motorcycle and things along those lines. The thing is, it's a lot of fun. The game has always been fun. This expansion really just adds a bit more to it. It adds some really great cards, which in the written review I'll go into a lot more detail about. But it's an excellent addition to the family of the game. It has a lot of rule-bending cards that change the nature of how you play if you have that card in play. But a lot of times those cards have some restrictions too. So you might want to play it and it seems like, oh, this is the perfect time to put this out. And then you go, ah, crap. He's gone. I wasted that card. Happened to me a lot of times. There's some unexpected turns that can be played as well. Overall, Nightfall Blood Country. Some people might say, meh, it's more the same, it's Nightfall, it's all the same thing, but it's the new cards, the new characters, in my opinion, and the new effects that come into play that make this a must-buy, if you like Nightfall.
Yeah, and Nightfall's a good game, like you said.
Yeah, I like it. I like it a lot.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
I think you like it more than I do, though, to be honest.
Yeah, I do. I like it a lot.
You're much more into the horror, and I like horror, don't get me wrong, but you're much more into the horror theme than I am.
I'm sure that's very true. That's and why, so, of course, Nightfall's right up my alley, you know?
Right. So, like, when I mentioned the podcast about the zombies, you're like, really? I hadn't heard about that. Oh, sweet.
Exactly. I'll be listening to that tomorrow. Well, the first game I'm going to talk about is Panic Station. Since I had no idea about the shortening of the reviews, my review is 15 pages long.
All right. Well, you just keep talking. I'm going to go out. I might go pick up a hooker.
Now, so Panic Station joins the ranks of other excellent co-op trader games like Shadows Over Camelot, Battlestar Galactica, and The Resistance. What drew me to the game, though, was the thematic similarity to...
Hang on. Time out. You threw The Resistance in with Battlestar Galactica and Shadows of Camelot?
Yeah, they're all co-op trader games.
But you said excellent.
I liked The Resistance.
Yeah, fine. All right. Continue.
Jeez.
Personally, I didn't. I thought that game was lame.
Did you play it?
Yes, at Origins with you.
Oh, that's right.
Yes.
What drew me to the game, though, was the thematic similarity to a movie that I just loved, which was John Carpenter's The Thing from 1982, featuring a bearded Kurt Russell, along with a group of scientists working at a base in Antarctica.
No, keep going. I'm just doing the music.
Gotcha. Facing off against a horrible parasite alien creature that could take over the bodies of the men to spread itself through the base. Friends quickly became enemies, as no one could be sure who was infected and who wasn't. Now, the theme of Panic Station is very similar. A group of players enter an army base to explore and destroy an alien parasite that has invaded the base. One of the players will become infected by the host secretly as the game begins, or within the first few turns. The host's mission is to infect the other players, who, in turn, try to infect other players until only infected players are left. The human's goal is to try to explore the entire base and find the hive of the parasites, and then burn it down using 3 cans of gasoline. Now, let me interrupt myself here first to say that you should go download the new version of the rules from the Stronghold Games website. There were several tweaks to the game and some clarifications that do make a difference in the play of the game. Don't make the same mistake that I did, because there were no instructions on how to put the little stickers on the wooden tokens. I ended up putting some of them on the wrong ones and had to peel them off and fix them. The new rules tell you how to put the stickers on, among other things. And the nice thing is that this game was only recently released and there's already new rules available.
You do know that the sticky side actually goes onto the wood part.
Right. Why won't these come off my fingers?
What the hell?
And I think that this shows that Stronghold and David, the designer, were right on top of any problems and corrected them as fast as they could. Panic Station is for 4 to 6 players, and 6 is better than 4. Everyone gets 2 player cards and discs in a chosen color, 2 check cards, one for positive infection and one for negative infection, and 3 infection cards, also in the player's color. After some manipulation of the deck to ensure that the host card is near the top of the search deck and the hive card is near the bottom of the exploration deck, you're set to go with the game. So every player has 2 characters, a human and an android. Now, the android is the only one who can shoot a gun.
What?
Yes, and they can't even do that until you find some ammo in the base.
So humans can't shoot guns anymore?
Let me finish.
No, I'm just asking.
This is explained in the new version of the rules. Apparently, the ammo brought by the team is too weak to penetrate the shells of the parasites.
Yes, penetration, yes.
And the only way to hurt them is by finding the special thermonuclear ammo developed by the now extinct team that was originally on the base.
Got it.
The ammo is too dangerous to be used by humans, so only the androids can use it to kill the parasites. Make sense now?
Not really. Go ahead.
I had a tough time resolving this in my head thematically, and the new rules did wrap that up nicely. In addition to the 3 infection cards, you're also dealt 2 additional cards from the search deck, and your main priority is to get some gas cans, because only they can help stop the alien infestation. The players all start on the same initial reactor room card, and they can explore in different directions, and there are ways to search rooms to get more equipment. Parasites will pop up and move around and attack people. you explore to reveal more rooms from the exploration deck, adding them on where they'll fit until the hive is finally revealed. So you're spreading out these cards across the table, revealing more and more of the base each time. You have to watch out for security doors, though, because you'll need either a key card to get through them or a computer terminal. That's just a gloss over the rules so that we can get to the meat of the game.
Yes.
The infection mechanic. At the start of the game, each player has 3 infection cards in their hand, plus 2 other random cards from the search deck. One of the players will most likely have this host card, and they are the ones who are looking to infect the other players. And the way this works is that each time a player's character token enters a room with another player's character token, they have to trade one card face down. If you're the host, you can pass one of your infection cards to the other player in the trade. If they pass a gas can to you, then
they pass gas? Yes,
if they pass gas at you, then they're not infected.
They're just kind of flatulent.
It was a good man, a flatulent man. But if they pass any other card, they do get infected and now are on the host team. In future turns, they will try to trade one of their own infection cards with another player, infecting them too. The players can say whatever they want as long as they don't reveal the cards they received. And this leads to a lot of, "Hey, he just tried to infect me," shouts. And the host needs to really rely on their acting ability to convince the players otherwise.
No, I don't believe that was truly the case.
If one of your characters gets infected, then they're both infected. Thematically, this is some sort of bio-connection between the human and the android counterpart.
I guess so.
And it makes a lot of sense in gameplay as well.
It's not making sense talking about it.
You can avoid trading by only one means, and that's by attacking the other player. Each character has 4 points of health, which you track by rotating the cards around. Players can attack each other and eliminate their characters rather than dealing with the whole "are you infected" problem. But you do need ammo. This also explains why each player has 2 characters. If one is killed, you still have 1 more left to try to win. If both are eliminated, then you're out of the game. But the game is short enough that it really doesn't make a difference. You can pass a gas can card to avoid being infected, but don't forget you need 3 gas can cards in order to burn down the hive and win the game, so you can't give all of them away. The infected players, though, have to manage their cards very well, because if you run out of infection cards in your color, then you can't infect anyone else, and you have to resort to a more violent solution, or free as many parasites as you can to attack the humans. But the parasites will attack you, too, so you gotta be careful. The only way to identify if someone's infected or not is that there's a heat scanner in the computer system. And if the players can find and activate a computer terminal, then you can scan everyone in the base. All of the players place their status cards indicating whether or not they are infected on this board, the host checkboard. Then they flip over the cards one by one, and this will let you know exactly how many players are infected.
But not who.
Exactly. And if you're lucky enough to find a rare portable heat scanner, then you can scan a specific person and check them so you would know that they are infected or not. What the game boils down to is that it is what you can make of it. The rules can be tricky to grasp at first, and if somebody screws up whether or not they're infected, it can ruin the whole game. For example, in our first game, one of the players got confused as to whether or not she was infected and had to ask for help, which let us know who the host was early in the game, and it made a distinctive difference on how the rest of the game was played out. Bad acting can blow it too, but by now a lot of us are familiar with the traitor mechanic and know who can handle it and who can't, acting-wise. Mm-hmm. It says that the game is for ages 10 and up, but I think 10 is too young. It's best played with young adults and up, in my opinion. If you can get a good group together, this can be a masterful game. There are strategies that can be explored, and everybody gets better the more you play. The tension can get high, the play comes fast and furious, and it's got a really rich thematic theme. It took me a few plays to find a group that it worked best with, but once I did, it was excellent. Watch out, though, for overly sensitive players, too, just like you would playing any other traitor mechanic game.
I don't know. I would think this game would be somewhat of a niche game because it's not something that you can take with you to play with people that you've never played games with before.
You could try. It would be like a shot in the dark, really.
Yeah, but it could be a huge disaster, right?
It could very well be. You know, it depends on the types of players. But I would say the same thing for Battlestar Galactica. I've played terrible games of Battlestar Galactica.
You've played games where fights were breaking out.
Right. It's like playing diplomacy.
Stop with the diplomacy. We never had fights over diplomacy.
You don't think so? Well, not you and I personally.
No, none of us had fights over diplomacy. That is the bad rap that people have. They've heard someone say that they played a game of diplomacy and somebody didn't do what they were supposed to do and they all got pissed off. It doesn't happen.
I seem to remember games where people got really pissed off.
Yeah, that's just because I was playing, but it didn't have anything to do with it being diplomacy.
My point was that any of these traitor-type games, without the right group of people, you're not going to have a good time.
It seems to me like it would not be a game that would make its way off your shelf for anybody coming over to play some games.
Could be. I don't know. Like I said, it took me a couple of plays to find a good group to play it with, but once I did, it was well worth it.
And the other groups you played it with were what?
They just didn't really enjoy it or didn't get how the traitor mechanic works. Yes, so flip a card up, say, look, I'm not infected.
You know, I'm not real sure if I'm infected here, so do you want to look at this to help me out here? I think that would ruin the game.
Right. Exactly.
All right. So the verdict is, if you have the right group of players to play it with, it could be a lot of fun. And if not, it could be a big pain in the ass.
That's fair enough. I think it's worth it to find the right group, to tell you the truth.
Like any game. Yeah, of course. Victory Point Games has announced a tentative release date for Steve Carey's Malta Besieged as December 15th. It's another in the extremely popular States of Siege line. That Scorpion of the Sea, Malta Besieged, is a solitaire game covering the pivotal World War II years of mid-1940 through 1942 in the often overlooked battle for the Mediterranean. You're placed in the role of the Commonwealth commander in the theater and must utilize every resource at your disposal to fend off unrelenting Axis attacks in order to ensure the survival of the island of Malta. Built upon the same States of Siege engine as the designer's previous 2010 Charles S. Roberts award-winning release, We Must Tell the Emperor, Malta Besieged features both familiar and innovative gameplay. Supply was the key element in the Mediterranean campaign, and so it is here as well. Players will have to safely shepherd vulnerable convoys and their valuable cargoes in order to effectively wage war. With the ability to trade supply for extra actions at the most crucial moments, this places an additional emphasis on that precious resource and also creates extremely tense convoy battles which will resolve as the game progresses. Ultra is a critical asset in the game, but beware of Axis counterintelligence. Spitfires can rule the skies, Gibraltar can block U-boat advances, Operation Hercules is a constant threat, and Admiral Cunningham himself can intervene on occasion. North Africa is not treated as a mere sideshow. Indeed, the struggle with Rommel, the Desert Fox, holds the ultimate key to victory. If Malta can hold out against the constant pressure, if a fortified Tobruk manages to stubbornly delay the vaunted Africa Corps long enough, then General Montgomery and his battle-tested 8th Army can possibly make a final dash from El Alamein to capture Tripoli and secure a glorious triumph. Raiding Axis supply lines to weaken Rommel's situation, scrambling hurricanes to provide air support for inbound shipping, attacking the Italians early before the dreaded Luftwaffe arrives, requesting British fleet escort for your individually named convoys, and maintaining the morale of a battered Malta are just some of the important decisions to be made throughout the game. Whew, that was a mouthful. Numerous theater-wide events such as the Fall of France, O'Connor's Desert Offensive, the daring raid on the Italian fleet at Taranto, the air assault on Crete, the evacuation from Greece, the sinking of the aircraft carrier Ark Royale, and the torch landings are all abstracted via card play and can have a significant impact on the overall conduct of the war. With that Scorpion of the Sea, Malta Besieged, it's all here. The only question is, will you have the wisdom, leadership, fortitude, and luck to prevail? Play this game and find out. I'm really looking forward to this one a lot.
Really?
Yeah, I thought We Must Tell the Emperor was awesome. It's one of our highest rated games.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. My wisdom's only 10, so I don't know how I do.
Yeah, maybe you better stick with Stomple.
Hey, did you know the For the Crown expansion is out now? You can get it?
Yes, I believe it just came out today or yesterday. Mm-hmm. It was announced.
Yep, Cover of Night, which actually I playtested, and it's a pretty good expansion for the game. I mean, it does add some interesting new options.
Twists.
Yeah. So
very nice.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, I know you really liked For the Crown. You play tested For the Crown and the expansion, both.
Sure did.
Yeah. So you got a credit.
Woot.
Now you should get another credit.
Is that extra credit?
Mm-hmm.
Sweet.
Yes. This time in the War Room, I'm going to review U-Boat Leader from Dan Versen Games. The Battle of the Atlantic was the longest continuous campaign of World War II, running from 1939 through to the defeat of Germany in 1945. It involved thousands of ships, stretched over hundreds of miles of ocean, and involved hundreds of convoy battles and single ship encounters. During the struggle, advantage switched back and forth between the U-boats and allies as new weapons, tactics, and countermeasures were developed and implemented. U-Boat Leader takes the Leader series to new depths. No pun intended. Letting players control a group of U-boats on missions in the Atlantic. The core system of the game will be familiar to players of other Leader games, allowing them to quickly get into the game. A major portion of the game is determining where to send your submarines. Do you concentrate your subs in one or two areas to form wolf packs, or spread them out in the shipping lanes to increase the chances of finding contacts? Or do you send them out on special missions, such as laying mines? You can also spend special operation points to supply your subs by adding search planes to help find enemy ships or by sending supply ships and subs to extend the endurance of the submarines. During longer campaigns, you need to manage the U-boat patrol rotation to keep subs on station. When a patrolling U-boat comes into contact with an enemy force, it can call other boats in the same patrol zone to form a wolf pack or attack alone. The action then shifts to the tactical display, where the U-boats try to close with and attack merchants while avoiding the escorting warships. When an attack starts, you'll have an idea of the number and general types of ships in the group, but you have to close with them to actually find out and identify what those ships are. U-Boat Leader includes four campaigns covering different stages of the Battle of the Atlantic. The Battle Begins, which covers operations at the start of World War II and runs to about mid-1940. The Happy Time, covering the period from mid-1940 to mid-1941, when the U-boats and wolf packs dominated the seas. Operation Drumbeat, which covers operations off the American coast and in the Caribbean in early 1942. As well as The Hunted, which covers the time period when the tide starts to turn against the German U-boats. It's designed by Dave Schuler. As I mentioned, published by DVG just this year, it's a solitaire game, and you can play it depending on what scenario or campaign. You can play it shorter campaigns. You can probably finish up in about 45 minutes to an hour. Longer ones probably run about 3-4 hours. Recommended age is 13 and up.
3 and up.
Yes, 3 and up.
I want a U-boat.
3 or more. I really like Dan Versen games.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed Field Commander Napoleon, Hornet Leader. No, I'm sorry, Phantom Leader. Really enjoyed that as well. And normally the components are really, really top notch. I have to be honest, this is not the case here.
Hmm.
I was very, very surprised. The counters for U-Boat Leader are way below the quality of counters that I've encountered previously. And one of the reasons is they're very, very easy to damage the counters. Normally, when you have a game that's got counters, you pop them out, you can punch them out. Sometimes, yeah, I know they sell these in various stores and online. They have like counter trimmers so you can make sure that they're completely square and everything. I don't go to that extent.
No way, man. Sheet of like 400 counters?
Or more, mm-hmm. Right. With these, they're just not cut correctly. So what I had to do is I had to make sure and take a hobby knife.
Yeah.
and actually score them. And you have to be really careful because you know how sharp hobby knives are. Yeah. Otherwise, you're going to slice right through a counter too. So I was very, very disappointed. Also, I was disappointed in the cards that were included. They don't seem to have gone through a proper cutting mechanism. And some of them had some rough edges and white along the sides. You don't have to worry. They're not going to like peel apart or anything like that. They just weren't as crisp and clean as anything else I've run across from DBG.
Huh.
As far as the maps and the player aid and the tactical display, those were all cool. I was kind of surprised the tactical display wasn't mounted like the battle mat in Field Commander Napoleon was, although I think that was an additional bonus that was included because there was also the battle mat that was just the cardboard. As far as the components go, I was a little disappointed with that. The game itself takes, a battle is anywhere from maybe 5 to 45 minutes. Like I said, the short campaigns run maybe an hour or two. Longer ones, of course, obviously, probably going to take you an entire evening or a couple of evenings to complete. The game is actually split up into different phases. Yeah. There's the strategic segment, which is when you decide what special missions your subs would go out on. There's the operations segment, which involves moving around your U-boats between the different sectors that are on the campaign map. And you also will draw event cards as you move them around. You also have the tactical segment, which is where the actual battles will take place. And battles are kind of similar to Phantom Leader. As opposed to in that game where your enemies really didn't move around, they move around all the time here. So I thought it's very cool with the tactical segment where you have to close in, you have to find out, okay, you know, what is this? And hey, oh, wow, it's a shipping convoy. Excellent. Yeah. Oh, crap. It's a bunch of escorts. No. The battles can bog down a little bit, but it does feel realistic.
Yeah.
And it's not extremely complicated either. Then you have the refit phase, which is pretty much where you're wrapping up your turn, you're reloading your supplies, restocking ships at port, and so on. This is definitely a leader game, and it shares a lot of various different aspects with Phantom Leader. It's not extremely long. It's not boring. It's a lot of fun. It seems realistic to me. I mean, obviously, I've never been on a submarine.
Oh, you haven't?
Well, okay. I was on U-505 at the
Museum of Science and Industry
in Chicago. So
there you go. See?
So, okay. So, yes, I have been on a submarine. So, yeah, this game is completely unrealistic. No, I really liked it. I think it's a great game. I'm just disappointed in the component quality. I think, in my opinion, the components, and yeah, I can live with components that aren't great, but I have to say it drops this down a notch from being in our list of top games to just a really good game.
Well, that's terrible.
It is. Well, you're a component junkie. I know
that.
Oh,
yeah, I am. It's true.
Which I believe in your upcoming review now, we're going to get a kind of a feel for how much of a component junkie you really are.
Yes, I'm going to ravage this game and its components.
Going to ravage it?
No. My review...
Yeah, you're a twisted man, I'm telling you.
My review is on The Legend of Drizzt.
Huh? Who?
The Legend of Drizzt.
Exquisite title.
Thank you. It's from Wizards of the Coast, designed by Peter Lee, and it just came out. It's fresh on the market, hot off the press. It's the third installment in the line of D&D adventure board games, consisting of Castle Ravenloft and Wrath of Ashardalon.
See, now, didn't we discuss this before? You were saying, no, there's four games.
Yeah. Okay, so you were right there. Are you happy?
Yep. No, I'm just saying, but that's what Wizards of the Coast is saying.
Yes. Well, it's true, because Conquest...
Personally, I think you're right, because Conquest of Nerath is a Dungeons & Dragons board game.
It is.
Yeah.
But these three, supposedly, you're going to be able to combine the components because they're all, they share the same gameplay.
Mm-hmm.
They're just different settings, you know. So Wizards suggests that the components can be mixed and matched to make new and unique adventures and dungeons to explore.
So it could be Super Castle of Drizzt?
Exactly. Now, but the problem is, of course, is that the games are all adventure-based. So you have mm-hmm. to wait until Wizards of the Coast puts out some adventures combining the games.
Yeah, I'm waiting for them to put out.
Before you can actually do it. So far, they've released three bonus adventures on their website that combine Ravenloft with Wrath of Ashardalon. But mm-hmm. I think you're going to need to wait a while before they get some out using elements of all three of them. What would help is if they had some rules for generating random adventures, maybe a mm-hmm. special deck of cards that help you make unique adventures that are different every time. But I digress. Legend of Dritzt is the first in the series that I've had the opportunity to play.
Yeah, I liked Castle Rape.
Yeah, you said you did like that. And, you know, that's one that I think I would like, too, because it's got the whole, you know, undead thing going on there.
Not so much. There's different monsters in that. Granted, yeah, there's, like, the golem.
Don't they have, like, the golem? Super vampire count?
Yeah, well, that's Ravenloft. Doesn't that count Ravenloft? If I don't know, maybe.
Count Wang too long? I don't know.
Yowza.
And this game follows the adventures of Dritzt Duerden and his companions from the Forgotten Realms series of books by R.A. Salvatore. And I have to say that the components in this game are top notch.
Spectacular.
Fabulous is what I have to say. It's got
wonderful.
There's over 40 plastic character and monster figures of different sizes and shapes and colors, including this one huge ass demon figure.
Is that a technical term? Huge ass?
And he does have one. It's got to be like 4 inches high and 4 inches wide, right?
Probably along the lines of there's a skeletal dragon in Ravenloft.
Yeah. Well, they do have a dragon in this one too. He's much small. He's smaller, but he's still way bigger than all the other ones. And then there's a couple of giant troll figures too. They're all in different colored plastic. Even the water elemental and the hypnotic spirit figures are in this translucent blue plastic, which is pretty cool.
Yes, they did that with some of the ghosts in Ravenloft, but I sprayed a primer over him and painted him.
Well, there you go.
Sorry.
This version also has these 36 interlocking, they're not dungeon tiles, these are actual cavern tiles because you're traveling through these caverns. So mm-hmm. I'm not sure how you're going to combine that with the dungeon tiles from the other two. But
The caverns lead into different rooms?
Could be. It's possible, I'm sure. Yeah. I'm sure they're actually working on it right now.
Could be.
They also have 8 character tiles. These are double-sided with level 1 on one side and level 2 on the other side. And your characters can actually level up during the game. Dritzt himself is a pretty good character because he gets 2 attacks per round.
I wouldn't think he would suck. I mean, he's got a series of books
right now. He's got his own game now. But, yeah. So I'm not going to go over all the rules. I'm just going to give a basic overview of the gameplay. So mm-hmm. to begin with, you select an adventure from this adventure book. And there's 13 adventures in the book. And they do provide a lot of different ways to play the game. The first one's a solitaire adventure so that it'll teach you the basic rules. And sure. In fact, the first 4 adventures are played using this basic deck of cards that slowly increase the complexity. Right. And after adventure 4, you add in the advanced deck of cards, which adds a lot to the meat of the game.
It's almost like tutorial missions,
almost,
right?
Almost, yeah. It gets you into the feel of it, you know, before adding a few more advanced concepts.
Yeah, each one's building on something you learned in mm-hmm. the previous one.
And cool. Now there's 5 advanced adventures that are for groups of 2 to 5 heroes. And there's 2 adventures that pit teams of heroes against each other. There's 1 competitive adventure. And then there's 1 adventure that has a traitor component added into it.
Dun, dun, dun.
And of course,
you and these games that have this has 1 adventure mechanics in them.
What can I say?
I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
Yeah, and Wizards promises they've released more adventures on their website in the future. And like I said, they have done so with both Wrath and Ravenloft. So I'm sure they will be coming.
It's really not that difficult for players to create.
Well, it's easy to create a
though.
Dungeon, but then you got to come up with a way. It's nice to have an object, you know, a goal. Rather than just walk through and kill a bunch of stuff and walk out.
Yeah, but I thought that's Dungeons & Dragons in a nutshell.
Help! I'm in a nutshell! How did I get in this nutshell?
Oh, yeah, I'm flashing back to one of our earliest episodes.
The adventure gives you all the specific setup, rules, and winning conditions for that particular scenario. In general, you'll place a start tile in the center of the table and place your heroes on it. Each turn, you'll move and attack, or attack and move, Then you'll draw a new character tile and place it if you go next to this unexplored edge of a tile. If you do place a new tile, you'll also be drawing and placing a monster on it. If you don't place a new tile, then you will draw a card from the encounter deck and resolve that. The final phase of a player's turn is the villain phase, and the monsters and traps that you personally have placed attack and move according to the instructions that are on their cards. If the villain is in play, he will also move and or attack. And it's important to note that when you place a monster or trap, their card goes in front of you, and they will only move and attack during your turn, as will the monsters played by the other players. The villain, however, moves and attacks during every player's turn, which makes them much more dangerous.
So why is it the, why is the villain?
Now, this sequence repeats with each player, leading you to explore and reveal the dungeon without respite until the climax of the adventure is reached and the villain is either defeated or the heroes are. Now, the powers that you get to select for your heroes, they come in different flavors. There's at-will powers that you can use each turn, and these are your hero's main attacks. These are all in the form of cards. There's daily powers, and these are generally more powerful attacks that can be used once, and then they're flipped over until you're lucky enough to draw a card that allows you to flip it back over again so you could use it again. There's utility powers that provide other special advantages, and they may or may not be flipped over after using, depending on what it tells you on the card. So the powers allow you to customize your hero to the way you want to play him or her. And when you level up, you usually get to pick one additional power to use, which is a nice little thing. The heroes themselves have several stats. Their armor class is their defense rating. Their speed is their movement rating through the squares on the tiles. They have have hit points, of course. And then they have a surge value. And the surge value is the value of hit points that you would regain when you use a healing surge token. And each adventure allows you to use a certain number of these healing surge tokens. In most cases, it's two. This is the pool that can be used by all the players. And if at any time you're reduced to zero hit points and there's no more healing surge tokens left, the players lose. Yes. And the game is over.
Over.
The Legend of Dritz boils down to a basic hack and slash game.
It sounds almost identical to Ravenloft, actually, except for the setting.
Yeah. Well, I think it, well, they say you can combine them, so it probably pretty much is.
And I'm not saying that's a bad thing, because the figures alone are probably close to being worth the value of the game
itself.
Well,
I agree with you there. They are excellent.
They really are. I mean, they are in Ravenloft, so I mean, if it's the same kind of quality, they are very, very nice. Because I painted them up.
Yeah, I know you did, and that's cool. So anyway, you move, you kill monsters, you get treasure, and repeat. If you're looking for something deeper, then you're looking in the wrong place. But hack and slash can be a lot of fun, as millions of people addicted to playing World of Warcraft can attest to.
Well, luckily there's no grinding.
Right, for experience.
Gosh, that's the one thing I hated about WoW was the, okay, I got to go find like 50,000 herbs. And I was like, seriously? Really? I'm supposed to be this great hero? How many great heroes do you know spend 5 hours a day?
Herbage?
Yeah.
Hey, if you want to be a good alchemist, buddy. And I did really enjoy playing Legend of Dritz, as did everybody that I played it with. The rules are not complex, and you're never really sure what the next card will bring. If you're unlucky enough to pull two trolls in a row, it can get pretty tense. But conversely, pulling the rare card that reads, "Do not place a monster this turn," will pull a sigh of relief out of you every time.
Everybody starts cheering.
Now, the development and marketing of these games by Wizards of the Coast, I do think is brilliant. Because the first thing that the kids asked me after we played was, when can we play D&D again?
Yeah, of course, sure.
And we haven't played D&D in years. And of course, I did have the same feeling myself. So it's an excellent design and concept for promoting Dungeons & Dragons. The box now, the box insert isn't as great as Conquest of Narrath.
Correct.
But still.
Yeah, because it's just throw everything in the box, sort of. Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure it's the same as Ravenloft.
But it was a good game.
I, I would have to say, at least with Ravenloft, and I enjoyed it. I thought, you know, a fun game. But it's kind of funny. I didn't sit there and think, you know, wow, I'd really like to play some D&D now. I think the games themselves, and granted, I haven't played Legend of Drizzt. I think Wizards has done a pretty decent job of creating some board games, at least that are based on D&D, that do stand on their own. You don't have to be into Dungeons & Dragons or know a lot about Dungeons & Dragons to pick these up and play.
No, you don't at all. Like I said, you know, the rules really aren't that complex.
No, not at all.
No. You know, it helps if you know what a hit point is and, you know, things like that. But how difficult is that concept?
Exactly. If you think about how many people play computer games, and a lot of them have hit points of some kind.
Yeah, that is true.
They don't have to be a Dungeons & Dragons player to understand what a hit point or damage point or anything like that might be.
Was that term invented by Gygax?
I think it was.
It's spread worldwide.
Yeah.
So good game, yeah.
Nice. We tease Wizards about stuff all the time, but they have cool stuff. Hey, I'd play Dungeons & Dragons if I found somebody who I thought could actually run a role-playing game up to my standards.
Well, good luck with that.
Yeah, okay. Come on. When we talk about our role-playing experiences and me running stuff, I don't think I was like the end-all, be-all GM or anything like that.
I'm not sure. I never played a game with another GM that measured up to those standards, just let me say. So,
and we did have a lot of friends who were not very good game masters, that's for sure. We've gone to conventions and played stuff by people who, one pops right in my head, there was a game called Fudge.
Yes.
And it was a generic rule set for role-playing, kind of like GURPS would be. And you could make it where it was actually diceless. I don't even think it's around anymore. I actually ran across the rules a few years ago that I had. I was like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I still have this. One of the authors was running a game, and it was kind of based on the novel Watership Down. And we were bunnies.
Yes, I remember that.
And it was not a very good game. And I kind of thought, well, geez, this guy's one of the authors of this system here. And he can't even run a role-playing game? What the? And we kind of got finagled into playing it, too. That was the funniest part. We were just kind of chatting at their booth and kind of got dragged into it, going off on an RPG kind of.
I may end up being forced to, not being forced, but the kids may want me to eventually run some D&D stuff for them. I've been looking at the essential stuff because I'm looking for something easy that is prepackaged that I don't have to do tons of prep work for.
We should throw together an RPG corner kind of thing.
RPG corner?
Yeah, I don't know. It's something. You know, we have our role-playing games section on the website, and we know that probably 90% of the people who listen to the podcast probably are not role-players. Right, they don't play role-playing games. So I wouldn't want to devote a whole lot of time on the podcast to role-playing games, but just little tips, little tricks that I had learned over the years. Like the first one I'm huge on is, who cares about the rules?
Right.
Seriously, who cares about the rules? Who cares about a die roll? If you know, okay, well, geez, blew that die roll. That's going to bring the whole game to a screeching halt. Then you know what? I would ignore it. Because usually when I would be running stuff, I'd ask you guys to roll dice for things, and you had no idea why I was asking you to roll dice.
Or you'd roll something, and we'd have no idea what you were rolling for.
Right. And there were sometimes I would roll dice just because I wanted to roll some dice. Had nothing to do with what we were doing, what we were playing. But I wanted you guys to think that, ooh.
Oh, what did we just miss? Ooh, we better search this room for another hour.
Yeah, right. Of real time. All right. I'm going to act out my searching through the room. Okay, so I'm going over. I'm going to look through this bookcase here. I'm opening every book, paging through. I'm going to roll another die, and that bookcase is going to fall on top of you. But yeah, that was my big thing. Don't worry about the rules.
Yeah, I think that's becoming a little more
prevalent. Doesn't matter. It's the story.
Prevalent nowadays. Like the steampunk game that I just went over. They're big on, you know.
You have a new review up, I believe, or you're putting a new review up of
from Uber Goober,
right?
And, you know, they've got a lot of good steampunk information in there because it's kind of a pretty diverse genre.
So
it like brings everything together really nicely and then gives you a basis for everything. But throughout, the emphasis on not on die rolls, but it's more on the actual role playing.
Well, you do need to roll some dice because everything in life has some sort of...
Random chance?
Yeah, random chance, I guess we would say. I know for a fact that you and I sat with our friends and stuff. Granted, maybe they were running something or somebody else was running something. And there's nothing worse than you're in the middle of an adventure. Everybody's having a good time. And we were never people who got like into our characters. You know, oh, yes, I'm Spotlight. You know, whatever. But, I mean, we'd run across something and all of a sudden be like, ooh, you know what? I have to look up that rule. Hang on.
Right.
Son of a... The whole game came to a screeching halt.
No, you make it up on the fly and then figure it out later.
There's nothing wrong with taking, you know, adventure modules and taking stuff that you think is interesting and throwing other stuff out. Just because it's a published adventure or something doesn't mean it has to play out the way that it's been written.
I think a lot of ours didn't play out the way they were written.
Oh, no. No, that's for sure. That is most definite. Anyway, hey, there you go. There's our first little RPG corner. Hey, we created that on the fly. Our final review is going to be Nitro Dice. You have the car, you have the nerve. Do you have what it takes to win on the open streets in a nitro-burning race for fame and fortune? It won't be easy with opponents that know how to cheat the game and drive the winding streets. You'll be dodging them and anything they can throw at you. Whoever drives fastest, smartest, and toughest will become the Nitro Circuit Champion. Designed by David E. Witcher, published by Minion Games just this year. It's for 2 to 6 players. You can usually get a game in within about 60 minutes or so. The suggested ages are 9 and up, although I have to say some of the artwork is a little, no pun intended, racy for kids of that age. It's not over the top, but it's a little bit of a kind of a fan service anime sort of look to some of the artwork for the women. It's important to keep in mind Nitro Dice is a card game that simulates a road race rally. So keep that in mind. It's called Nitro Dice, and it is a card game that simulates a road rally.
Wondering that.
The dice are actually used to mark your position on the map and to indicate what your speed is. You begin by rolling a 10-sided die. Then you line up every player's die in descending order at the starting line. You make sure everybody's on 0 on their die to start off the race. Everybody also starts the game with 9 cards, a condition marker, and you also get 2 nitro tokens, which can actually give you extra speed. It's a racing game, so you know at the beginning of your round, you're going to increase or decrease your speed by 1. You can change your speed by as much as 2, but you have to toss out a card to do so. And then you turn your die to indicate what your current speed is. Once everybody's set up their speed, you move, and the player with the highest speed goes first. If it's a tie, they're broken by the race position in descending order. One thing I thought was very, very cool about this game is the way the tracks are made up. You can create a variety of different racetracks with them. So I thought that was very, very cool. It's not as if you're, let's say, for an example, that you finally got a copy of this, Formula D.
I sure did.
You have a track, and granted, these tracks are pretty big, but you have a track, and that's the track you're going to race on. And if you want more tracks, well, then you're going to go buy more tracks. With Nitro Dice, you get to create your own tracks. So I thought that was pretty cool.
That's kind of nice.
So what you do is you have different turns that you can make, and you're using these cards. And you have to play these cards depending on what kind of moves you're making. The track's actually made up of cards from the game. And every time you enter a new card, you have to discard a card of that same track type from your hand. So you've got left turn, right turn, and straightaways. If you don't have that type, you can discard 3 cards. If you don't do that, you take a point of damage. And taking damage affects a couple of things. The maximum size of your hand that you can have at any one time, and your top speed. You start off with 9 points. That means that you could move up to 9 spaces. You could have a speed of 9. If you end up taking 3 points of damage, that means you have a maximum speed of 6, and your maximum hand size is 6.
Yeah.
Pretty easy, right? So you discard extra cards to change lanes, to drift, to use your brakes. If you go too fast, you might hit other cars that are on the track, you know, other dice that are on the track. If you go too slow, you know what? You're not going to win. You can use the Nitro tokens on straightaways, and you get to move two extra spaces, or actually use that to sneak past two cars that are blocking you that you couldn't get past normally. Actually, you will take some damage, but it could be worth it. After everybody moves, their turn is over. Then everybody gets to draw cards up to their maximum hand limit. First place gets three new cards. Last place draws five new cards, and anyone else in between is going to draw four. You also have a garage that you can go stop at to fix your car. And for every point of movement that you spend there, you get 1 point of damage back. The player who is the furthest past the finish line by the most spaces on the final turn is the winner. I thought it's a pretty fun game. I thought it was a lot of fun. It's one of these games where there's a little more to it than you would think, simply because, for one, you never seem to have enough cards, and a lot of times you don't have the kind of cards that you actually need. The cards actually play the biggest role in Nitro Dice. The rules weren't exactly crystal clear, but you can figure them out pretty well. Could have been a little clearer about a couple of things, but they're pretty well put together. It's not very complex, and that makes it very, very easy to teach other players. Also in the rulebook, they've got quite a few different map layouts that you can add, that you can create. So it creates a lot of different options available for you. Now, if somebody's looking for a serious racing simulation of any sort, obviously Nitro Dice is not going to float their boat. But for people who are looking for a nice, fun game that plays really well, I would say with about anywhere from, two-player game just seemed a little, 3 to 6 players, it does play really well. And it is a lot of fun. All right, so there you have it. There's our reviews for this time around. Anything else you wanted to add?
Yes. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody.
I was going to say the same. We hope that everybody out there is going to have a wonderful Turkey Day. It looks like the show itself will probably be up and available on Thanksgiving. So if you're listening to this and you just finished up a big dinner and you're kind of zoning out, that's okay. Hopefully we can keep you awake for a little
while. No, my reviews put people to
sleep. So, yes, all of our Americans.
My relaxing voice. Hi,
it's your radio voice. Yes, I'd like to review Legend of Drizzt.
And why don't we listen to a little smooth jazz?
I was going to say, I'm going to play a little Kenny G in the background as I... The components are excellent. So yes, for all of our American friends out there, happy Thanksgiving. To everybody outside the U.S., hey, hope you're having a great day, too. We will catch you next time.
All right.
Elliot, care to take us out?
You've been listening to the Gaming Gang Podcast with Jeff McAleer and Elliot Miller. If you'd like to know more about the topics or games we discussed in this episode, please visit our website at www.thegaminggang.com. If you would like to have your opinion heard or have a gaming issue you'd like us to discuss on a future podcast, you can visit the Gaming Gang Guild on BoardGameGeek or call us at 480-779-7365 and leave a message. If you enjoyed listening to our podcast, please rate us on iTunes. Some of the games discussed on our show were provided to the Gaming Gang in the form of review copies. On behalf of everyone here at the Gaming Gang, thanks for listening.